Welcome to the Rainy Day Rabbit Holes podcast, your escape from the mundane.
Dive into the rich history of the Pacific Northwest with us and let your mind wander down the rabbit hole.
Because in the Northwest, it's always raining something weird.
So when the devil says to you, "Do not drink," answer him, "I will drink and write freely just because you tell me not to." One must always do what Satan forbids. Martin Luther.
Well, I've got one better. Give me a woman who loves beer and I will conquer the world. Kaiser Wilhelm.
I like that one better. You're right. That one's good.
It suits us.
I am Shay.
And I'm Jody.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
Well, it's Tacoma Beer Week, my friends. And if there is one thing I can get really excited about, it's beer. And wouldn't you know it, Tacoma has some freaking fantastic beer.
Shay, this isn't a beer podcast. This is a history podcast.
Well, we're in luck. All of Tacoma's golden nectar of the gods comes with a rich, heady history. See what I did there? Heady, like head on a beer. Yeah, you got it. You got it. Do I need to explain the joke further?
That's why I was over here smiling as I saw it. We have a very special guest with us here to talk about our boozy history. Someone who does a whole-assed research in contrast to our half-assed research.
In fact, someone whose whole-assed research was the main source for our recent episode about Roy Olmsted, king of the Seattle bootleggers.
He's the author of several books, including the one Shay already referenced, Seattle Prohibition, Bootleggers, Rum Runners, and Graft in the Queen City, as well as a book we will be using on our research for upcoming episode, Seattle Mystic Alfred M. Hubbard, Inventor, Bootlegger, and Psychedelic Pioneer.
He's also a historian, a contributor to our favorite resource, historylink.org, one of the co-hosts of the Dim Lights and Stiff Drinks podcast, and an all-around interesting dude. Well, please welcome Brad Holden. Brad, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, we're both very excited to have you here again, because this is 2.0 of trying to record this whole story.
Yes, thanks for coming back and spending more time with us.
So happy to do so.
We recorded an episode with Brad's podcast, Dim Lights and Stiff Drinks, a couple of weeks ago at the Parkway Tavern in Tacoma, Washington. And unfortunately, the audio for this portion of the podcast just didn't turn out as expected. But the rest of our episode that we recorded for their podcast, you can find over at, what's your website for the podcast?
Dim Lights and Stiff Drinks, the Dive Bars of Seattle. And if you just Google that, it'll bring you right to our webpage. We're also on, you know, Spotify and Apple and all that.
We'll make sure to have links to the website for the podcast and their Spotify in the show notes. But hey, Brad, why don't you tell us a little bit about what Dim Lights and Stiff Drinks is all about and maybe how it started? Like, how'd you guys all the four of you get together? And
So, I'm trying to remember what year it happened. I think it was 2021, so a few years ago. Anyway, it's me and a couple friends. We all go way back to the 1990s. So we've been friends for like 30 years at this point. And when we're hanging out and stuff, a lot of times we're going to bars and doing that kind of thing. And at some point we decided, why don't we start a podcast?
And
you know, what can we do? So we were going over ideas, and I think it was Lou's idea, one of my co-hosts, and he was like, what about a dive bar podcast? And I had already kind of established myself as like a local historian. By that point, my Prohibition book had already come out. So I brought it up another level. I was like, why don't we do it? Why don't we record on location? And why don't we go over the history of each place while we're there? So it just kind of evolved from there. And then we started doing it. And we're on our fourth season right now.
That's incredible. So
exciting.
Yeah, it's been really super fun. And, you know, each episode we go to a different dive bar, usually in the Seattle area, and we record live on location there at the bar. We go over the history of the place. We talk a little bit about what we're drinking, what they have on tap, that kind of thing. And then maybe a little neighborhood history. And it's just a lot of good kind of light banter back and forth as we're discussing all this stuff. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a really fun podcast. I love learning about the history of the different locations. I think the first one I listened to was Jules May Tavern in Georgetown, which is often purported as being the oldest bar in Seattle. But you set the record straight that it is not.
That's correct. It's the Merchant Cafe. There's three of them down there. There was four at one point that, you know, all alleged to be the oldest bar in Seattle. All of them are very old. All of them go way back. All of them have like incredible history. So not a diss on any of those bars. But yeah, the oldest one research shows is the Merchant's Cafe. They're the oldest place that has been continuously serving drinks going back before Prohibition.
I actually was just watching I don't remember which show it was. My husband was watching one of those ghost stories and the Merchant Cafe was on there.
Ooh.
Haunted.
Before that. Is it? Oh. Mm-hmm. If there were such a thing as ghosts, sure. Sorry, I'm the skeptic. I'm like, haunted, schmunted. A ghost needs to show me and show up in front of me and then I'll believe.
If I die first, you're in
you
trouble.
Better haunt me. You had better haunt me.
I'm very skeptical too. No, it's funny. I had one of those shows reach out to me about a year ago.
Oh.
To record local history. But the thing was, at first it sounded really cool, but then they revealed that they're actually going to hand me a script and they wanted to record me as though I'm an actual historian saying what the history of the place is, but it was like history.
Oh, I knew it. I knew it.
And I was like, no way, no way. I'm not going to lose my credibility just to be on like this goofy ghost.
No, that's, don't lose your credibility for that.
Reality TV is the most deceiving.
So speaking of your credibility and your experience as a historian, what got you into the story of the Northwest Prohibition characters?
Yeah. It's an interesting story. And not to sound cliche, but it actually really does go back to my childhood. Okay. So when I was a kid, my dad was really into collecting and restoring old cars. That was his thing. And so a lot of weekends, you know, we'd be going to swap meets and auctions and flea markets and stuff. And we'd pull up at a swap meet and he'd throw me a few bucks. And then while he was off looking for car parts, I'd be off doing my own treasure hunt, looking for toys and comic books and things like that. And I did this throughout my childhood and my teens. So it's something that kind of stuck with me. And what it really instilled in me is this love of like old things, you know, anything from old cars, music, fashion, just old things was always cooler to me than newer things. So fast forward the early 2000s, right? These new TV shows are coming out like Pawn Stars and American Pick stuff. And
love American Pickers.
I love that show too. Love and it's like what I had done when I was a kid. I was like, I know that world. And so I started getting back into that world. I started doing it myself. And what I started looking for when I got back into it was the main things I was looking for is local bits of local history. You know, any cool item or artifact or anything that looked like it came from the local past here in either the Seattle or Tacoma or Puget Sound area. It might have a cool backstory. That's the kind of stuff I was finding. And then I would go home and research it and find out its backstory. And that's, for me, that's how I learn most of my local history. I feel like I have a really good understanding of local history, but it's through this process over the last couple decades of doing this, of finding this old stuff.
Like hands-on self-taught.
Yeah, hands-on self-taught, exactly.
And through physical artifacts, too, which is a different way than just learning about a concept and then just learning the history of it. You actually have a physical tie to the history, which makes it more impactful.
Yeah, I feel so. I think so, yeah. It's been a lot of fun. I'm still doing it to this day. Now, as far as the Prohibition part of it, so probably about 2016, somewhere around there, I was at an estate sale. I was in the Ballard neighborhood of Seattle, and it was a multi-generational estate sale, meaning like it had been passed down from one generation to the next, going back to the early 1900s, the turn of the century. And those are my favorite kind of estate sales because they got the oldest, coolest, most interesting stuff.
So
that's
rare.
The best junk.
So rare.
Yeah, I love it. Love it. And I went to this estate sale. I was looking around the main floors, wasn't finding a lot. There was some cool stuff, but nothing was really truly jumping out at me. And so I decided to go downstairs because a lot of times that's where you find the most interesting stuff, either, you know, up there or in the basement or if there's a barn or something. So I went down to the basement and I found the remnants of an old copper moonshine still. And I knew right away, could tell from it had this beautiful patina. So I knew it was old. I was like, this is super cool. So if this is down here, you know, what else is down here with it? And I started rooting around a little bit, and I found this box of papers, of documents, and I started going through them. And through that, I was able to find basically the backstory of this moonshine still, which was, you know, the original owner of it, the great-great-grandpa of this house, you know, was using it to make moonshine during Prohibition. And he was the neighborhood supplier, and he eventually got caught and got locked up, got sent to prison.
Holy cow.
But it got me thinking, well, what did happen here during Prohibition? It kind of sent me down that rabbit hole because, you know, usually when you hear about Prohibition, like on TV and the movies and books and stuff, it's over on the East Coast St. Louis, Chicago, New York, places like that. But never Seattle or Tacoma or anywhere in the Pacific Northwest. You never really hear about that. So yeah, I went down the rabbit hole trying to find it, read and learn as much as I could about it. And after a couple of years of doing this, going pretty deep, I was like, man, there's this incredible story that happened here that has never been told. Like certain pieces of it have been told here and there, but not the entire story, how it was connected. None of it went really deep into these people's lives. And, you know, it was incredible stories I was finding out, not just the criminal part of it, as far as like the bootlegging and the rum running itself, but the people's stories that were involved in it. Their stories were amazing. You know, Olmsted, Albert, and everyone I cover in the book. So that's how I eventually ended up writing the Prohibition book. It was from this old moonshine still that I just happened to stumble across at an estate sale.
Did you know right away what that was when you saw it, the moonshine still?
Yeah. I had seen other moonshine stills before just from picking. And Prohibition has always been one of my, you know, the era of history, especially American history, that I've been most interested in. You know, it's always been an appealing era to me. So yeah, I definitely knew what it was when I saw it.
Well, one of the things that really strikes me about the story of the Prohibition story here in the Pacific Northwest is how it contrasts with the violence of the East Coast and how you've brought to life how a lot of the moonshiners and rum runners of the Pacific Northwest abhorred the violence and bloodiness that was common on the East Coast, and that they would not let their organization be involved in other vices like sex work or drugs or guns, and wouldn't even let them carry guns.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting part of it for sure. And you know, you saw that with Tacoma's bootlegger that we're going to talk about here, Pete Marinoff, and then up in Seattle it was Roy Olmsted. Both of them were very gentle, civilized men and no violence whatsoever.
They were the good lawbreakers.
Yeah. Say though that so Washington State went dry in 1916, 4 years before national prohibition.
Oh wow.
We're always ahead of the game.
Progressive.
Yeah. We are very progressive.
Always ahead of the curve. But that 4 year period of time from 1916 to 1920, there was a first wave of bootleggers before Olmsted, before Pete Marinoff, and they were like Old West outlaws. You know, they were having shootouts in the streets, and it was very much like Old West meets kind of the modern world. It was the last remnants of the Old West. So that first wave of bootleggers was they were not the civilized gentleman bootleggers like once national prohibition took effect. But yes, once national prohibition took effect, you know, we had a very civilized lot of bootleggers up here.
It's Tacoma Beer Week right now, which is one of the reasons why we have you on the show today, Brad.
Yep.
Because we wanted to bring a little bit of history of beer in the Grit City. And I mean, it just so happens that you have some knowledge about some of that history. And today we are going to talk about Pete Marinoff, Tacoma's own bootleg king, right after this break.
Alzheimer's doesn't just affect individuals. It impacts entire families.
On Saturday, September 28th, 2024, we're walking to change that.
Join us for the walk to end Alzheimer's in Seattle and help support those facing this challenging journey.
Every step we take brings hope to families struggling with Alzheimer's.
Every dollar we raise funds critical research and support services.
But we need your help to make a difference.
Not in Seattle? No problem. There are walks all across the country.
You can find one near you and be part of this nationwide movement.
Donate to our cause or join a walk in your area.
In Seattle, look for the Limitless Studio team and be part of our community fighting for a brighter future.
To learn more or donate, visit act.alz.org or search for Limitless Studios team or walk in your area.
You can also find a link at our website at rainydayrabbitholes.com.
Together, we can support families and work towards a world without Alzheimer's.
Will you stand with us wherever you are? Now, Brad, we've established on our podcast on a prior episode that Roy Olmsted was really the absolute king of the bootleggers in the Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. So how does Pete Marinoff and Tacoma fit into this prohibition story?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Roy Olmsted, as you mentioned, he was kind of the king of the Puget Sound bootleggers. He had the biggest operation. But like what we were talking about before, you know, they were a very civilized lot of bootleggers up here. And in fact, they had a bootleggers convention at a downtown in the early 1920s. And they used Robert's Rules of Order to democratically decide, you know, liquor prices and who's going to control which territory and stuff.
Highly official. Nice.
Kept their basically their word to that. So there was no violence or anything. The fact that they were using Robert's Rules of Order to decide this, meanwhile, you know, on the East Coast, they're shooting at each other and blowing each other's cars up and stuff. So it's kind of funny how completely different it was over here in Seattle. So yeah, so they decided on territories. I believe, based on my research, that's when it was kind of decided that Marinoff was going to control the Tacoma territory. And everyone was seemingly cool with it. So while Olmsted was controlling the big, you know, Seattle bootlegging racket, Pete Marinoff, he was Tacoma's bootlegger. They called him Legitimate Pete because, you know, like we were saying, he was, he was very civilized and gentlemanly about how he did things. He didn't engage in prostitution or narcotics or gambling. He just was smuggling sealed, legitimate, you know, top shelf booze down from Canada to Tacoma.
Yeah, we'll leave the prostitution up to Seattle's mayor. Hiram Gill with the 500 room brothel that he gave the green light to on Beacon Hill.
Yeah.
With Wappy.
Yeah.
So one thing I was wondering, though, about this convention, you know, anytime you have a group of people come together, there's got to be organization. Like, I want to get into the gritty details of, like, of the organization. Did they have a secretary that set this up? Were there swag bags? You know, how did they decide this? What was the hotel that they were at? How was parking? Did they get validated?
Right. Well, surprisingly, they didn't keep records from this bootleggers convention.
Oh, so
there's no paperwork out there that I know of.
I mean, that is a shame.
No records exist. But, you know, from it, like I said, they were able to establish liquor prices and stuff. And so it does provide us some information as far as, you know, like what the prices were and who was controlling which territory and that sort of thing.
So what was Legitimate Pete's operation like in Tacoma? I mean, was he mainly involved in just importing the liquor from Canada, or did he have any moonshine operations that he was involved in here in Washington State?
He didn't have any moonshine operations that I know of. He was just doing rum running. That's how he was obtaining the booze. And I guess to clarify some of the terms, because a lot of people don't know what the different terms mean. So bootlegging is smuggling booze on land. It came from the Civil War. Soldiers would smuggle bottles into their camps by, you know, hiding the bottle in their boot next to their leg, bootlegging. So that's refers to any kind of smuggling booze on land. Rum running is smuggling on water, either, you know, with boat or ship. And then moonshining is just making your own booze with a still. Now, as far as Marinoff, so he was a bootlegger. He operated in Tacoma on land, and he was in charge of distributing where the booze went to, which clubs and speakeasies in Tacoma it was going to. And as far as how he obtained his booze, he would hire rum runners. He was these kind of contractors for hire that, you know, own their own boats and stuff. And they would get hired to go up to either Victoria or Vancouver, because when national prohibition was happening here, booze was legal up in Canada. So that's where all the Puget Sound bootleggers, that's where they got their booze from. They just had it smuggled down from Victoria or Vancouver. And that's what Marinoff did. And he would hire rum runners to go up and make runs for him. And then they would load up their ships and then bring it back. And rum running was a real dangerous profession. but it paid really well. So it was like high risk, high reward. Yeah, the Coast Guard was always on their ass, and the Coast Guard, all the Coast Guard ships had cannons and machine guns, and they basically had a shoot first, ask questions later approach to it. So that was your main concern. There was also pirates out there that were waiting for rum running ships to come by so they could rob them of their booze. And then there was just most rum runners operated at night. They were least likely to be caught, but you know, there's a lot of floating logs and stuff out. So a lot of rum running ships just got completely demolished by hitting these floating logs, you know, out in the water in the dead of night. So it was dangerous, but if they made it back, then they had a big paycheck waiting for them. So that's how Marinoff got his booze. So people in Tacoma knew that the booze he was distributing was safe. There was a lot of dangerous...
poisonous moonshine. There was a lot of wood alcohol floating around. Yeah. And for people that don't know, that's when you ferment wood scraps, you get dangerous levels of methanol, which can cause blindness. It actually attacks the optic nerve and or death.
So it's fascinating to me that they were not shooting each other up, but the danger really came from all sorts of outside areas, but at least they weren't shooting themselves or each other, I should say. So that wasn't competing. They weren't, the competition wasn't with amongst other bootleggers or rum runners. It was with the law.
Was it with the law? Yeah, the most, actually the most violent kind of brutal, any kind of brutality or violence that did take place was at the hands of the federal agents, especially the Seattle ones. They were just a bunch of thugs. There was a team of 12 of them. And the head guy, William Whitney, that was running it, he was basically a thug. And they were all alcoholics. So they would just basically raid bootleggers wherever they had their booze, take the booze from them, arrest them, and then confiscate the booze and then drink it.
Well, I think it's funny how they would stage these photo ops of them smashing bottles of booze, but I'm assuming then that's just like, okay, we're going to set these 20 bottles aside for the photo op, and then the 200 bottles that we've distributed to the men.
They probably knocked back a few pulls on it first.
Well, that was one thing that Jody asked when we covered Roy Olmsted, which I used your book mainly as my source for that because it really is the most comprehensive story about Roy Olmsted and Prohibition in the 1920s, how William Boeing was raided and that he had an extensive wine cellar. And Jody was like, what did they do with all of his wine?
You know, I think he actually managed to get it back. I think that they actually confiscated it. And then he was so powerful that he eventually, through some kind of, I don't know how he did it, but he had his lawyer file a special, you know, lawsuit, and he was actually able to get it back.
Oh, that's insane.
Nice job. Yeah. Boeing. So I was wondering about Pete before Prohibition. Is there much about what kind of industry he was in and his story before he became legitimate Pete?
No, I wasn't able to find anything about his backstory. You know, he suddenly just appears in the newspapers during Prohibition from what I saw. They did say he supposedly had an Eastern European accent and dark features. I have one photo of him, and he looks like he fits that profile. So he apparently came from somewhere in Europe, but it's unknown like what country exactly and when he arrived in America and what he was doing before Prohibition. He was always kind of a businessman. So that it tells me that he was kind of probably running some kind of a business. I don't know if he was like maybe operating a store or a saloon or a bar. I'm not sure, but he definitely had business savvy and he ran a really good operation from kind of like a businessman.
What do we see about his arrests and run-ins with the law during Prohibition? I know a lot of these bootleggers would get caught and arrested, and then they'd be able to bribe their way out of any serious charges most of the time. Did he go through that like Roy Olmsted did?
No, not as bad. So he got busted a couple times by the Coast Guard. He had his own ship, and sometimes he would make his own runs up to Victoria or Vancouver. Oh. And do his own rum running. And I don't know, like, if he was just doing it for the thrill of it or to cut costs or he couldn't find a rum runner at the time. But he was going up himself. And there were a couple times where the Coast Guard caught up with him. And he was arrested once by the Coast Guard. But one time they pulled him over and he wouldn't stop at first. So they opened fire on him.
Oh,
and then
shoot.
He finally stopped. And he was just like, what are you guys shooting at? I wasn't doing anything. And they couldn't find any booze on his ship. but they knew something was up, so they towed him back to the, you know, Tacoma waterfront. And when they got there, they discovered that he'd actually attached all his booze to ropes and had them like over his ship in the water. He was just dragging them in the water.
Like seaweed. Yeah. That's excellent.
Yeah, he just had them in the water. Pretty funny.
So tell us a little bit more about how bootlegging contributed to modern day racing of hydroplanes.
Yeah. So it's kind of like NASCAR. So over in the Appalachia, you know, down in the South, there's a lot of moonshiners over there making their own hooch. And then they'd make moonshine and then they would go and sell it to different places. And the cops were always chasing them when they were delivering their booze. So they started developing fast race cars, started putting beefier and beefier engines in their cars. And after Prohibition, they're like, well, these souped up cars are fun. I want to keep doing this. And that's what eventually NASCAR. And they say that's the same thing that happened here, but with rum running and hydroplanes. So these rum runners, in order to stay ahead of the Coast Guard, at some point, one of the rum runners realized, you know, hey, there's a bunch of spare World War One airplanes in Boeing Field, and they still have their engines in them. I bet if we took one of those out and put it on a ship, it would make it go pretty fast.
Yeah,
and
that's supposed to be fast as hell.
Airplane fast.
Much to the chagrin of the Coast Guard. And it became very popular. And most rum runners at some point started putting airplane engines on their ships. That just kind of became a standard feature on rum running boats. And, you know, after Prohibition, they still enjoyed taking these super fast boats out on the water. And a lot of people say that's what evolved into, you know, modern hydroplane racing. And the rum running ships kind of matches, because they were very flat to the water to avoid being shot by the Coast Guard. Mm-hmm. So you see how the design probably did evolve into the what we now know as, you know, the hydroplane boats. And a lot of where rum running was most prevalent in places like here in the Puget Sound, over in the Great Lakes region with Detroit, and then down in Florida, those are the hot spots of hydroplane racing.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah, we went a couple of years ago to Lake Chelan. They do a Mahogany and Merlot festival where it is wooden hydroplanes, wooden hydroplanes that they race on Lake Chelan. And it is cool. It's very cool. Very loud.
Yeah, they used to have hydroplane races there all the time. I don't know if they still do, but I want to say like in the 50s and 60s, that was one of the hot spots of hydroplane racing in here in the state.
Well, do they still do that for Seafair?
They do. It's just, it's not nearly as popular as it was. So starting pretty much in the 50s and then into the 60s and 70s, hydroplane racing was the sport here in Puget Sound. This was before we had any professional sports teams. It was before the Mariners or the Seahawks or anyone. This was our main sport. And Seafair, the hydroplane races at Seafair was such a big deal. They had, you know, live on all the TV channels.
Yeah. All three of them.
Yeah, I remember this as a kid. Chip Hanauer.
Yeah, totally. And they were like the rock stars and superstars, yeah. The hydroplane. People would watch the races just like how they watch the Super Bowl now. But once we started getting professional sports teams here, it kind of started going by the wayside. And they still do it. We just had Seafair this past week and they had the hydroplane races, but they're just, you don't really hear people talking about it so much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah, none of us could probably name a current hydroplane driver like we used to be able to, you know, like with Chip Panauer and people like that. But
yeah, I just looked up the Seafair because I was like, that's got to be coming up. And I realized
it was last week.
I just missed it.
Yep. Yeah. I think it was this last weekend. The Blue Angels big thing was, I think, Saturday.
I missed it all somehow.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about, so Prohibition shuts down, the bottom falls out of the bootlegging business. So what's Pete going to do now?
Yeah, well, you know, so he's a businessman, like I said. You know, there are basically two different types of bootleggers kind of nationwide, either the thug variety of bootleggers, and they usually didn't last very long. They were usually ended up dead in a shootout or going to prison. And then the businessman types. And most of the Puget Sound bootleggers, the Olmsteds and the Marinoff, they were the businessman variety of bootleggers. And you really saw that in Marinoff. So Marinoff was really smart. Starting in the early 30s, the writing was on the wall that Prohibition was probably going to be repealed here soon. It became really unpopular. There was a lot of pressure on the government to, like, you know, repeal it. And all the tea leaves were saying, yep, it's probably going to get repealed. So Marinoff bought a brewery. There were still breweries that were in operation during Prohibition, but obviously they couldn't make beer. So what they were doing, the way they were surviving, is they were making near beer or soda, malts. Some of them were even like doing, like making furniture and stuff, anything to kind of keep the operation going. Well, what Marinoff did is he saw that writing on the wall. He knew Prohibition was going to be repealed soon. So about a year before it got repealed, he bought a brewery in Tacoma that was making near beer.
Do you know what the brewery was?
Well, when he, I think it was called the Walla Walla Brewery. I think it had started in Walla Walla and then had moved to Tacoma right before National Prohibition took effect, or before Washington State. And then it became one of those near beer factories.
Okay.
And it just soda and stuff. When he bought it, he renamed it the Northwest Brewing Company. This was in 1931. Prohibition was repealed in 1933. So he basically kept it going, making near beer, but he retrofitted it so it was ready. So once the green light was given, like, okay, you can start making beer again, he was set to go. So when, you know, in April of 1933, when they allowed beer to be sold again, which is now National Beer Day, he was ready to go and went right into overdrive. So he became a brewery owner when Prohibition was repealed, which was pretty ingenious, going from a bootlegger to running your own brewery.
He really did become legitimate.
Legitimate Pete.
That's right. And Northwest Brewery was a big brewery. It was like the top brewery in Tacoma at that point and throughout the 1930s. And they would sell Marinoff beer. And that was a very popular beer. And what ended up happening is in the late 30s, so the Teamsters, which, as you guys are probably well aware, was very well connected with the mob.
Oh, yeah.
They had a deal set where all the beer delivery drivers had to be Teamsters members. They had to be Teamsters people. And that way they can control the beer market. So that's just kind of how things were back then. And at some point, Marinoff had a falling out with the head of the local Teamsters. And Marinoff was like, you know, screw you. I'm going to use my own drivers, you know, with you guys. So he started using his own guys to make his beer deliveries, like to the taverns and stuff like that and the stores. And that, of course, didn't sit too well with the Teamster.
Yeah, this isn't going to last long.
No.
Got an education.
Northwest Brewing to try to prevent his drivers from being able to leave the brewery and make deliveries. And there was, of course, some kerfuffle broke out, some fight broke out when this was going on. And one of the Teamsters members ended up getting shot dead.
Oof.
You know, it wasn't Marinoff who pulled the trigger, but it might as well have been, because it was because of him refusing to use Teamsters drivers that led to this. And, you know, as I mentioned, the Teamsters were well connected with the mob. So basically a hit was put out on Marinoff's head after this happened.
Yikes.
So he fled down, he took him and his family, sold the brewery, and then fled down to California, and he became an executive of an insurance company.
Wow, what a pivot.
Yeah, right?
From the king of the South Sound bootleggers to a brewery owner to an insurance salesman.
In California.
In California.
He's a flexible man.
Right, right. So that's basically his story. But yeah, you know, I really would love to see his story get out there more in local Tacoma circles. Because, you know, he's a cool part of Tacoma history for sure. And he was the top bootlegger back then. He was the Roy Olmsted of Tacoma. So he deserves his due.
Do you know what happened to his brewery? Did it morph into another brewery happens?
Yeah, it did. It became Silver Springs Brewery, which lasted until the 1970s. And then it was closed down. And the building was actually there until 1986. And then it was demoed to make way for the I-705 interchange.
We've driven over it multiple times, darn it.
Yeah, and I think Marinoff died sometime in the, I think he died in the 1970s, I want to say.
Did he become a teetotaler like Olmsted did?
I don't know. I don't know if he was a teetotaler or not. Yeah, that I don't know.
Well, you know, at least he didn't have to spend any time on McNeil Island. I mean, insurance salesman in California might not be that much better, but at least you're free.
Toss up, for sure. Tell us a little bit about how Prohibition and bootlegging has impacted the alcohol industry to this day.
Yeah, well, the biggest impact it had, so prior to Washington State going dry in 1916, the reason it went dry was because here in Washington and mostly in Seattle, things had just gotten so out of control with local vice, with gambling and prostitution in the saloons. Like Seattle especially, it just, following the Alaskan gold rush, the entire town just turned into like one big crazy place. If you'd go to downtown Seattle during the turn of the century, you know, every street, every corner, every block was filled with saloons, box houses, billiard parlors, opium dens.
Oh, for everybody, a box house is a brothel. It just has little, tiny little rooms that are boxes.
Yes. It was like
Las Vegas of the 1800s.
Yeah, very much. It was the vice of the world. So anyway, because of that, it triggered this temperance movement to kind of come in and, you know, start raising hell and start becoming very politically active to hopefully undo it. And they mostly were going against the saloons because the saloons had become so problematic. They were kind of like the crack houses of their time as far as like how many social problems they were causing. They become just these really rowdy, out of control places, and a lot of men were, you know, spending all their money there and abandoning their families and
picking up a disease as they go along as well, an infection.
Yeah. So anyway, so then it eventually, as a result of that, you know, the entire state went dry in 1916. Well, when Prohibition was repealed in 33, immediately the Washington State Liquor Control Board was formed. And their main mission was basically to prevent the liquor industry from turning into what it had been before Prohibition, with all the saloons and everything just being so out of control. So they went the opposite direction and then basically came up with all these really super draconian rules about how, you know, liquor was going to be handled now that Prohibition was repealed here in Washington State.
Well, and I remember you mentioning in your book that one of them was, besides the limit on the AVB of beer, which was like 3.2%, which was like, what is that going to do? That's like drinking water. The rule about women ordering beer or ordering a drink or standing at a bar by themselves.
Yeah, those were some of the craziest rules with regards to women. So, a woman could not go and order a drink by herself. She had to be, you know, accompanied by a man, a date. And this was all to prevent prostitution from taking place. But it was just, they went so ridiculously overboard with it. And in fact, it wasn't until 1969 that a woman could actually
69.
Go to
the bar. Sorry.
Oh, that's mache.
I knew you were going to go there.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go on. 1969. What happened?
That was the year I was born, by the way.
69. Sorry.
Good grief, Shay. You've only had one beer.
Yeah, so they had all these draconian rules, and also like they couldn't have like windows. Like they had this weird window rule where you couldn't have any windows like on the street. So in other words, people couldn't walk by on the street and look in and see people drinking beer.
Oh, this is why all the old ugly bars from the 60s have no windows on the outside.
Correct. That is correct. Wow. Or they have really small windows. Yeah. Yeah. Just a lot of really weird rules like that. And it's funny. I remember when I was out promoting the Seattle Prohibition book, you know, I meet all kinds of people doing these readings and stuff. And I had this lady came up to me, this elderly lady, and she was talking about it. And she was talking about how back in the 50s, she was out running errands with her 12-year-old son, just the two of them, and their car broke down. And of course, this was before cell phones or anything, so she had to find a payphone to get some help and get a tow truck. And the closest place, the only place nearby, was a tavern. She went into the tavern not to order a drink or anything, just to use the phone, mind you, and they wouldn't let her come in unless she was accompanied by a male. So she had to go back out to her car and get her son, and then with her son they let her in the tavern to use the payphone. How crazy is that?
Good grief. That's ridiculous.
So that's the most lasting legacy of Prohibition, really, as far as like how alcohol, it's been all these crazy liquor control board rules that have kind of slowly been unraveled over time. There's still kind of a few weird ones on the books, but for the most part, the really crazy ones have been overturned, luckily.
What's one that you'd like to see changed, overturned?
Current one? Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
I stumped you.
He did stump. Current ones. Oh, I know. Like, here's a good example. So there's still, and I don't know what the cause of this. So you guys may have heard of this about a year. I guess it was about a year ago at this point. The Liquor Control Board, agents from the Liquor Control Board, raided a bunch of Tacoma gay bars And there was a big stink about it because it seemed like they were targeting certain bars. But they, as it came out, they were writing all these weird infractions. They didn't catch any of these gay bars doing anything too egregious. It's not like they were serving beer to minors or like the bartender was back there getting drunk or anything like that. None of the what you would typically view as like normal liquor infractions. But they did write all these weird infractions. Like they went to this one gay bar and there was a guy without a shirt on out there dancing or whatever. So they wrote an infraction for exposed male nipple. And I remember in the paper going out,
no shirt, no shoes, no service.
But that's weird. That's an infraction. Just a dude at a gay bar around without a shirt on and they're writing infractions for this. So I guess,
they would run out of like ticket books if they really were to go in there on a Friday night and give tickets for no shirt on.
What type of gay bars is like there's a bunch of shirtless guys on the dance floor, you know?
Right.
It's humorous at this point that they would write tickets for such a thing. But that just goes to show you there's still kind of like these weird ones on the books.
That is fascinating.
So, yeah. Brad, you have written 3 books at this point, right?
Correct. Yeah.
So we've got the Seattle Prohibition one about Roy Olmsted mostly, but a lot of the Seattle bootleggers and rum runners. You've got the one about Alfred Hubbard, who worked for Roy Olmsted and then turns out to be a very, very interesting character who was, how'd you describe it? The Johnny Appleseed of psychedelics?
Yeah. Yeah. No, his story was crazy. I stumbled upon his story when I was researching my Prohibition book. And when I set out to write the Prohibition book, you know, I knew I wanted to cover certain people, Marinoff and Olmsted and Johnny Schnarr, but Hubbard wasn't even on my, I'd never heard of the guy before. But once I started getting deep into the research, his name started popping up in all these just weird and crazy ways. And at some point I was like, okay, this guy is part of the story. I need to learn more about him. And then I just went down this crazy, crazy rabbit hole about his life story that is, you know, it's like something from a movie or something. So as soon as I was done writing my Prohibition book, I was like, I want to write his story right there. This guy definitely deserves a book. And so that led to my second book, the Al Hubbard book.
Which my mom is currently reading. And she every time I see her, she's like, oh my gosh, it's just amazing. I can't put it down. When my husband finally stops talking to me and I get a chance to read. And then what was your third book?
Okay, my third book I co-wrote with this guy, Peter Blecka. He's a local music historian, and it's The Lost Roadhouses of Seattle. And it's also, you know, Prohibition related because it covers the roadhouses. And basically what the roadhouses were at some point in the mid-20s, the Seattle police started cracking down on all the speakeasies and clubs, illegal clubs and stuff in downtown Seattle. And at the same time, they were building highways, the first highways, because cars were becoming such a thing, north and south of the city, you know, the old Pacific Highway, Highway 99. And basically what happened is as they chased the speakeasy owners up, they opened up these new clubs on these highways just outside of King County, out of the jurisdiction of the police. And they became known as roadhouses. So from like 1924, I'd say, through the 40s, basically you had this whole circuit of these crazy nightclubs north and south of the city known as roadhouses. And so that's what the book covers. It covers their history.
Are you working on any upcoming projects?
I'm taking a hiatus from book writing because book writing, it's an intense endeavor. It's kind of like a mental marathon, if you will. And it just kind of takes over your life. And I love my books that I wrote. No regrets there, of course, but I am taking a vacation from it. And right now I'm just doing some freelance writing. So I'm currently, I write a monthly column for Seattle Magazine, a local history column. And then I'm also one of the contributing writers for History Link. And that's probably the one I enjoy the most. I love writing for them. I love being part of their organization. They're terrific. And for those who don't know, HistoryLink.org is an online encyclopedia of Washington state history.
It is our number one resource for our podcast. So we are constantly calling out HistoryLink.org. In fact, like, we're going to have to start donating money to them at some point.
Yeah.
They're wonderful. They started in 1999, so they actually predate Wikipedia. They were one of the first ones
They're probably more accurate.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, they are.
I can't go in and edit it, right?
No. Well, I mean, we've got guys like Brad Holden and then friend of the pod, Michael Sullivan, contributing over there. In fact, there friend of the pod, Michael Sullivan, on the board of historylink.org.
Yes, it is. That's right. Yep.
Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us and sharing the story of Pete Marinoff. This was incredible. It is a great way to celebrate Tacoma Beer Week. And so let's all raise a glass to Brad and legitimate Pete. I don't have a glass. I have a can. So I'm going to clink the can. Clink.
I did cheers to my beers.
So you can find Brad on the podcast Dim Lights and Stiff Drinks at dimlightspodcast.com, as well as on Instagram at Seattle_artifacts. And that's where he posts about his finds, because you still go out and pick, right?
I do. Yep. Still out there.
There's some fun stuff on there.
So I'll include his link tree, which has links to all things Brad Holden, his multiple books, articles, television appearances, including Evening Magazine, which, as we discussed before, my mom has been on too, as well as you.
In the 80s.
And I got to say, it was the 90s.
Early 90s. I'm just thinking back to
how
she looked.
Her appearance on Evening Magazine might have been more impactful than yours. I don't think you gave CPR to a chicken.
Did you save my life?
So it's basically all things Brad in one place. And so everybody go buy his books. They are excellent. And I have read a lot of history books lately that have put me to sleep. And his keeps you up. It is a page turner. You want to finish the book before you go to bed. They are so well written. His articles are fantastic. Check out his Instagram, and you can even go stare at him occasionally. He does occasionally do presentations in the Puget Sound. Do you have any presentations coming up?
Yeah, I do actually. So August 12th, I'm going to be doing an online presentation through the Snow Isle Library system.
Great.
So you can just go on the Snow Isle Library and register for free. I don't even think you need to be like have a library card through Snow Isle Libraries, but it's online, and that'll be at 6 p.m. And then on September 15th, the Wallingford Historical Association is hosting a prohibition themed event at Murphy's, the Wallingford neighborhood, and I'm going to be there for that. So.
Ooh, we might have to come. Can we dress up?
We definitely can.
Prohibition. Can we wear flapper dresses?
Oh, yeah.
Definitely should show up as flappers. I'm going to be dressed up as in some 1920s gear. So.
Oh, do you have a fedora?
I don't have a fedora. I have one of those, gentlemen, what do you call them? The newsboy cap.
Oh, a driver cap. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we'll look for that. And we'll have links to that in the show notes on our website. And so you can go check out all of those things. Thanks, everybody, for being here today. Make sure you are subscribed, because we are going to bring you more bootlegging tales. I am diving into Brad's book about L. Hubbard next, and that is going to be one of our episodes in September. It's a wild ride of bootlegging and psychedelics and who
interesting.
Knows what.
And during World War II, you name it.
So in the meantime, make sure to go back and listen to our episode about Royal Olmsted, again, inspired by Brad's excellent book on Seattle Prohibition. And your support means the world to us. And the best way to support us is by telling a friend or a family member, and just send them to rainydayrabbitholes.com. And you can also give us some beer money by becoming a patron on our Patreon or buying a shirt. We've got great new designs. We've got tumblers, totes, all sorts of merch. Again, rainydayrabbitholes.com. That's the place to get everything. If you want to get more about Brad, we will make sure we link on our website and in the show notes. And then also, it is Tacoma Beer Week. So go to tacomabeerweek.com and you can find out about all the great events. And we will be attending some of them. There is a Pretty Gritty Tour event that will be happening tomorrow on Thursday, August 15th at 5 p.m. in the Proctor District. He's giving free tours of the Proctor District. And then every night there's something fun happening in Tacoma for Tacoma Beer Week. So check that out and maybe you'll run into us. And once again, thanks to Brad for joining us. And we'll have you on again. for sure.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, no, this has been great. Thank you for having me on, and I'd love to come back on someday.
Well, we'll talk about Al Hubbard again. Maybe we'll get my mom on. She'll fangirl all over you.
Yeah, that will be fun.
All right. Well, we will see you next time, and
see you down the rabbit hole.
Hello, I am Kevin. I am the host of the Tyrant in Training podcast. It's a improv comedy podcast, and to help explain what exactly it is, I brought along my fiancée, Celine.
Hello.
Well done. Okay, Celine, what is the Tyrant in Training podcast about?
It is a podcast where you bring on guests and you ask them what they would do if they were ruling their own country, and you ask a bunch of fun questions.
There's loads of questions like, what would be the name of their island, and what political scandal would they be involved in?
So here's what happened.
I don't know the words to Gangster's Paradise.
The money will go back to the homeless eventually.
Celine, laugh. Perfect. You can listen to the Tyrant in Training podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you get podcasts. You can find Tyrant in Training on its website, tyrantintraining.podcastpage. You can also find me online at Kev Ryan Carson. Listen and wonder, why am I interviewing these guests who have awful opinions?